His story for my life. For we live by believing and not by seeing. 2 Corinthians 5:7. Trials and temptations are markers of our journey. However, living in faith, being able to endure and persevere, and having growth will be the marks of our successes. This workshop, this kind of experience, this conversation that we're going to have is primarily about how to step into God's plan for our lives, how to live God's plan for our lives, right? And in the sense of not so much like the blueprint. I know there's some other workshops that are talking specifically about that. Ours is taking more of the look into what trials actually present us with opportunities to mold us and to shape us into basically to have the heart that God wants us to have so that we begin to actually crave the things that He wants us to crave so that we don't do the fearful, well, I know God's going to call me to do something I would never want to do. Because that's what everybody's... People come to faith... I shouldn't say everybody, sorry. Very generalization. People come to faith, and so when people come to faith, typically, you know, there's this fear. God's going to call me to do what I don't want to do. There's a fear of I'll never get to do what it is that I do want to do. Because God doesn't want that for me, because that would be fun. And for some odd reason, we typically think of God as like this orator, the narrator, the coach that wants to take a sinner and put him in the point guard position and make him play point guard, even though everything about him says he ought to be the center on the basketball court. Sorry, on the basketball court. Everything about him says he's built for center, yet God's going to make him play point guard. And he's going to be miserable, but it's okay because he's doing what God wants him to do. And so we typically, I think, approach God's plan for our lives like that, especially at the beginning. And then we start to know God better. And so then we're kind of like, well, I don't know. Like, we start to respect God more and we start to love God more. And so we say, well, I'll just do whatever He wants me to do. And so if that's it, I'll just kind of suffer along. And typically we end up on this kind of like treasure map. Trying to find X on the map, which is God's will for our lives. And we think that if we can find it, that we'll discover a kind of a place of arrival. I don't know if euphoria is the right word, but like a place where everything is just grand, you know, because we're there. So everything's come together. And so I'm going to share a little bit about my story. I know Adam got to hear a little bit about it. You guys have probably heard a little bit of it. And then you can just think about it. And then we're going to dive into James 1 and look at some other passages where we see how the things that God allows, the circumstances that come into our lives, have the opportunity to shape us if we actually persevere in faith. And hopefully in the midst of this conversation, we'll realize that when we talk about persevering in faith, what we're really doing is we're relying on the convictions of who Christ is. You know, Mike, my boss, has Alzheimer's. No, sorry, he doesn't have Alzheimer's. He has Parkinson's disease. And so there's this, he has to live with the reality that God has allowed him to have Parkinson's disease, and yet that God is still love, as 1 John tells us. And so if he goes to his Parkinson's disease first and says, I have Parkinson's, and then tries to see God as love, it's more difficult than it is to go to the Scriptures and say, well, God is love, and in the midst of His love, I have Parkinson's disease, because the foundation has been laid of love. So he already knows who God is. And so hopefully as we step into this, as we walk through this conversation of pursuing God through faith, we realize that really the only way to persevere in faith is to exercise that faith in the very character of who God is. Because without that, we really don't have much to hold on to. You know? If God isn't love, if we don't believe that God is love, if we don't believe that God will hold on to us until the end, once we've entered into this relationship with Him, then how will we ever expect to make it? And if we can't really expect to make it and there's no hope of making it, then, you know, then what are we doing? In 2000 and, well, I grew up in church. My mom was very faithful to have me in church, which is a blessing. Grew up in church, and in 2003, I accepted a tiny soccer scholarship to play soccer at a small school in Kentucky, and I went there with a girlfriend, and 2 years later transferred with no dream of playing soccer and no girlfriend. So I had some moments in between where I was very distraught. I remember coming home one day and just kind of yelling at God and crying. Because I couldn't understand what was going on in life. I was trying to connect the dots, and they weren't connecting. For me, it seemed like. And so I was like, why am I so frustrated? I made a really tough transition to step out of high school, where everything is totally structured for you, to step into college, where you have the freedom to do what you want to do, and you're responsible for that freedom. Just to rabbit trail off that a little bit, I think sometimes that's the way it is with God too, that God gives us these freedoms, and that what scares us and what really bothers us is that when we come to terms with the reality that God has given us freedom, we realize that that makes us responsible, and we can't turn around and hold God hostage for everything that's happened in our lives. And if we could only hold God hostage for everything that happened in our lives, then we could abdicate our responsibility from having to live that life. And so we say that we want freedom, but on the other hand, the hard reality of it is that once we have that freedom, once we've come to realize that we really do have freedom in Christ to do, to live, that we have to live with the responsibility of what we've done with that. And at the end of the day, we are responsible to stand before God and say, this is what I did with my life, God. And God knows it. So it's funny that, or I guess it's not funny, that I was wrestling with that freedom even in college, trying to come to terms with, so used to somebody telling me what to do at every hour. Now I am here and I have all this opportunity and freedom, and I really wish somebody would just tell me what to do. Because at least then, they told me to do it, you know? I'm not responsible for it. I had like a 1.8, got put on academic probation. After 2 years, I got my GPA up high enough to transfer to the University of Kentucky. And in 2006, on March 26th, at Porter Memorial Baptist Church in the second pew in the end seat, I said, God, I'm making a mess out of my life. Will you do something with it? I don't really remember going up front. I may have. I'd went up front before and talked to the pastor and stuff. And I never had Jesus was always the Son of God for me. I remember that growing up. I remember when I was 13 going down and making a profession of faith, because I'd made one earlier, but I'd struggled with assurance. And I thought, hey, everybody else is going up now. It's a revival. Jesus hadn't changed for me. So I thought, what a great time just to go up and make sure everything's good with God. And so everybody was doing it, and it was a great time to do it. But on March 26, 2006, I had set some of these kind of barriers up in my life where it was like, as long as I don't cross these lines, me and God are still okay. He still loves me because I haven't done these things. And then I crossed them, and I realized I was just making bad choices that were not only destroying my life, but they were also destroying other people's lives. And I was scarring up people's lives and scarring up my life. And people were allowing me to do it, you know. I mean, and I wanted to do it in the sense that the flesh craves those kind of things. And so anyway, March 26, 2006, I told God, I'm making a mess out of my life. Will you do something with it? Next year we went on a trip, and God really spoke to me in the sense that I saw my sins laying on the cross on Jesus, and it was for the first time I'd ever really had kind of a visionary experience like that. And I haven't had a whole lot of them since. It just happened. And I remember crying and crying and crying and crying because seeing my sin laid upon Jesus as he hung on the cross. Fast forward a little bit, bad relationship to bad relationship. I took 20 hours my last semester of college at UK and 12 over the summer just to graduate because I was in such a bent to get out of school because I was so stressed about what I was going to do when I graduated. My mom said that I struggled to enjoy the trip along the way because all I did was work and go to school. I probably made 5 friends in a university the size 28,000 because I was just introverted, I was insecure, and I was stressed about what I was going to do when I graduated. I had really individually tried to walk with God some after March 26th, but I hadn't found community, and I wasn't looking for community, and I didn't know that I needed community. I found a good biblical Sunday school teacher that I enjoyed going back home and listening to, and so every weekend I would go back home. Eventually, kind of found myself, I say eventually, I chose to put myself back in another unhealthy relationship. And so when it ended, and I had this experience at the retreat that we had in the Smoky Mountains in 2007. Best I remember, everything was over with at that point. I graduated in December, but I was actually finished in August, long story. And I took a road trip that ideally I thought was going to last 3 weeks, which was longer than any trip I had ever been on away from home. I just worked and went to school. So if I went on trips, I went with my parents. It shows you how disconnected I was. My roommates, who were very godly and loved Jesus and pursued Jesus and lived their lives like Jesus, they would take road trips to football games and stuff, and I was just totally uninterested because, like I said, I wasn't looking for community. I was in this individualistic. People tried to get me connected to college ministries, and I was like, no, I don't want any of that. That's not really. I got to go home every weekend and see my folks, and not because they wanted me to. I was just comfortable there. In 2007, when I graduated, I saved up some money and took out a little bit of a loan, which I shouldn't have done, ideally. It just shows to show you how God will work even in the midst of mistakes that you make, because now I think I would look and say the borrower is slave to the lender. So why take out money to go do something? Why not just work and save up the money? But nonetheless, I took out money because I hadn't really, that verse hadn't really sunk into me at that point. And I went to a bull riding school in Kansas for 4 days and a horseshoeing school in Oklahoma for 2 weeks. So technically, I guess the money was kind of like an investment because the horseshoeing school in Purcell, right outside of Norman, my dad had 160 horses that he shod full-time aside from working like 60 hours a week at the company he works for. And so I thought, you know, I'll step in and shoe horses and I'll sell equipment or something like that. So I guess the money was really like an investment for tuition, but anyway, I'd prayed about it, wanted to be a good steward of it, went. The bull riding school lasted, on the third day I realized I was not going to be a professional bull rider. I got stepped on, and I'd rode some calves growing up, but I had stopped because of soccer and I had a buddy that his arm broke. And so I hadn't done it for years, and I thought, well, you know, now's the time. I graduated school, we'll see if I can do this thing. And on the third bull, I got stepped on, and I went back to the hotel and just laid there by myself and just kind of swollen up. And I thought, you know, this isn't as glamorous as I had anticipated. That was at that point I determined I'm not a professional bull rider. After that, I went down to Norman or Purcell, right outside of Norman, for 2 weeks for the horseshoeing school. And if I remember correctly, I was having a quiet time all through this. I mean, I was walking with God. I'd gotten away from the stuff at home, the bad relationships and all that kind of stuff, and was just glad to not have those responsibilities, you know, that I'd freely, like, stepped away from that stuff. And sometimes it is so freeing just to get away from those things. And I know that it was for me. And on the way back after the 2 weeks, I stopped in Fort Worth because we'd been there on vacation, and I saw Stephenville on the map, which is the rodeo capital of the world. And so I thought, you know, all these rodeo people that I grew up watching on TV live in Stephenville. A lot of them did. So I'll go down there and get some pictures, take them back with me. So I go down to visit. It's about 1 hour and 15 minutes southwest of Fort Worth. And I really just fell in love with it. And I had kind of thought about working at a ranch at some point. I thought, how cool would that be? I grew up on a farm. How cool would it be to work at a ranch in Texas? Had an ag degree, ag economics with a business minor from the University of Kentucky. So I started praying to God for a job at a ranch. And 2 days later, God put some people as I was pursuing. God put some people in my path that I connected to. And this guy gave me a whole list of places, of ranches that might be willing to hire me. I was about to quit because it was on around the road out in the middle of nowhere. I had no idea where I was. I didn't know anybody. I'm 13 and a half hours away. When I went to the hotel, I had them move me from the ground to the second floor because I didn't know anybody and I'd never been there before. And so I was afraid somebody would break in the middle of the night. I didn't know what would happen. So I'm like, I haven't been away from home for more than 2 weeks of my life. And I'm thinking, so they put me up on the second floor or something. At least they'd have to come through the window. They couldn't break in the outside door on the outside of the hotel. This is kind of like my state of mind. So this guy was on out the road and I just kept going because I thought, maybe he's a little farther up. I went and I found him. He writes me this whole list of people that might potentially hire me. The first people that I got a hold of were actually right outside of the city limits of Stephenville. And I looked back and there were so many places that were like an hour from Stephenville, that were nowhere close to Stephenville. And this guy was the first person that I got a hold of. I went over and met him. He kind of realized, I think, that I was on this journey trying to find life for myself and trying to build my own life. And he gave me an opportunity to work there. So the guy at the ranch bought a futon. I put it together, and I slept on it in his living room in his trailer on the ranch for about 3 months. In the meantime, I go to First Baptist Church in Stephenville to meet a guy named, I didn't go to meet anybody. I just went to go. I'm like 20-something. I probably thought there might be some good-looking girls there. Truth be told, I was in love with Jesus, so following Jesus at the same time, good-looking girls are never bad. I'm like 22 years old, single. And I meet a guy named Nick Cooper that immediately connected with me when he heard that I was from Kentucky. He starts talking about he's from Arkansas, and he starts talking about football and the SEC, and so all of this kind of talk. And I see the intentionality now as I look back on it and think about how he was so intentional about reaching out and grabbing a hold of me. So for the next 7 months, Nick gave me his life on Thursday mornings through discipleship. And I listened. I saw him. He was giving me his life. He was allowing me to tell my story. And at the same time, he was also feeding me. And then I would show up on Thursday nights to their college event called Paradigm. A guy named John Reynolds would teach about what it meant, the call to come and die. And so, even though it seemed, it was just very romantic, I think. Because it was something that, at least for me, sounded like for the first time I'd ever heard before. If you'd asked me about Jesus being Lord, I could have probably told you that I'd heard that before. If we talked about Jesus saving, coming to die on the cross for the sins of mankind, I would have told you that I'd heard that before, and I believe those things, and I know Jesus should be Lord. But hearing Randall's really explain Romans 12, 1 and 2, therefore I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your body as a living sacrifice, and talking about really the call, if we're going to follow Jesus, is to come and die to self, was just radical for me. And it was very new, and it was very fresh, and it was as if God had really was just growing seeds that these guys were planting in my life. So I remember sitting out in the parking lot one day, and I said, God, I'm not a rancher anymore. At this time, I'd gotten really connected to the college ministry, and I thought, I don't want to keep working on the ranch because they were looking for somebody that was going to be there, just live. They were looking for somebody that wanted that life. And by this point, I'd gotten connected with this college ministry, and I was like, wow, this is really exciting. These people are chasing Jesus. They're moving, like they're actually going somewhere, and they're doing things, and I want to be a part of it. And so it's going to take my time. And so I'd come to terms that the ranch probably isn't going to work out for me. And I sat out in the parking lot one day, and the housing, I was eventually going to move out of the guy's living room. And so we were going to have to figure out something about that. I sit out in the parking lot one day at a Taco Casa in Stephenville, and I said, God, I'm not a rancher. Can I do something different? And I just remember smiling and telling God, I feel like you're about to do something. I walked in to sit down at the restaurant to eat at Taco Casa, and a guy gets up, walks across the restaurant, and offers me a job. So I got to do something different. He said, are you in college? Because I'm looking for somebody to work for me. I said, well, I'm not in college, but, you know, I might know somebody that would work for you. And in the back of my mind, I knew it was me, but I didn't know this guy. Again, I was trying to kind of, my car still has Kentucky license plates, so I'm still trying to be cautious about people that you run into that you don't know anything about. Awesome guy to work for. Ended up being great. We had dinner one night, and I took a buddy that I'd met in the college ministry with me just so we wouldn't be alone. And we had dinner one night, and yeah, he was we built a roping arena, which I would have never perceived myself doing, but it was great. He paid me well, and I had the freedom to be connected to this college ministry stuff. So anyway, we ended up going to Los Angeles with the college students, which is another thing. You know, this guy let me take off to go to Los Angeles with them. And while in Los Angeles, I met a lady named Melvita Wright, who held me in the back as I cried one night during the revival. And it was as if God said, why are you running from this ministry thing? Like, you just need to do this. So I came back and I surrendered the ministry. And the next year I started at Swibbetts at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And that's where I met Kels and Max Barnett and John Strapp and some of those guys, because Max would bring them in to teach the courses. And so after 2.5 more years of school, I finished last December. I was going to go out to Portales, New Mexico, and everything. I went out there. It seemed like God was totally at work there. I wasn't really excited about going, to be honest with you. I just thought, this is the next step, I guess. Like, if this is what I need to do, then let's do it. I thought, it's going to be cool. At the same time, I thought, didn't really seem like it was, I wasn't excited a whole lot when I went out to visit, but I thought, hey, if this is where I need to go, then this is where I need to go, so we'll do it. The emotions are kind of, you know, trying to put them on the back burner. Say, if this is it, this is the next step. And it seemed like there was going to be money there and all kinds of stuff. Literally, I call a week later and talk to the same person that it seemed like everything had come together with, and everything fell apart. And so I'm left to kind of go, okay, what do we do now? By this point, I've worked at the ranch. The guy came up for the construction. I worked with him. When he got done doing his construction, I'd surrendered to the ministry about that time. A guy from the church came up and said, if there's ever anything you need, let me know. He ended up hiring me because we got done doing the construction, and that guy went back to San Angelo, so I needed a job. So I worked for him doing maintenance, at which point later I worked for the retirement home that he owned but sold. From the retirement home, I worked at the Port-A-John company. So I'd had a lot of just kind of jobs here and there, doing part-time stuff or whatever. And so when I graduated, I was like, you know what, the Port-A-John stuff is great, but let's do something different now. I'm through with school, so maybe I can do something different. So I went back to Kentucky for 6 months, and for the first month, I just sat on the couch and read my Bible and prayed and tried to figure out what I was going to do. And I didn't want to be a burden on my parents. And so I'm like, you know, I had a little bit of money, so I didn't want any money from them, but at the same time, I thought, you know, eventually when this money runs out, I'm going to have to get a job somewhere. And so I pushed snow for a little while with my uncle, and I delivered flowers because I had delivered flowers when I lived there before, when I went to the smaller school. Excuse me. So anyway, in the midst of that, I'm talking to churches, and nothing's coming together. One church said, hey, you know, we're all for it. If you'd like to come up here and work with us, we just don't have a lot of money. It was up in Lexington where I went to school. And, you know, I've been away from home for 3.5 years. Now I'm back in there. My parents are not any younger. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't really know if I want to leave because I'm here with mom and dad. And I hadn't really seen them for 3.5 years. I mean, I'd come in to visit. But so I thought, you know, if I can just sit somewhere close to home, that's what I'll do. So I went up to Lexington and I applied at like 8 different Starbucks, every one of them they had. Talked to them all. I think I called them all. Visited several of them. Nobody showed any interest whatsoever in hiring me, as far as actually doing anything to like say, oh yeah, you know, when could you start? So then I talked to another church that was getting ready to plant a church there. It wasn't working out. Nothing was coming together. It just didn't seem like it fit right. And so I was like, well, what in the world am I supposed to do? And I came across a psalm. And it's Psalm 37, 23, and 24. And it says, if the Lord delights in a man's way, he'll make his steps firm. Though he stumble, he will not fall, for the Lord will uphold him with his hand. And so I memorized it because I thought, I want to know what delights the Lord. Like, I don't know what to do next. We live in a world where we have all these kind of opportunities and options that I could just get in a car and drive to New York and try to get a job at a restaurant. But what is the Lord delighted in? And if He is delighted in something in particular, then I believe that He'll make my steps firm in that direction. So, I called the North American Mission Board, and Max Barnett called me back because he was my connection to the North American Mission Board. And he said, Ryan, I think you should really go out and visit Mike Story. And I thought, 8 months prior, I thought, I don't want to work at a BCM, and I don't want to raise financial support. So, God will do anything else, but I'm just not passionate about those things, so I'm not going to do those things because that's not really what I'm interested in doing. What I'm interested in doing is working at a church where Nick worked at First Baptist Church in Stephenville, and I'm interested in having a salary, even if it's not a whole lot. But some people seem to get, they're okay with raising money. I'd sit in on Max's fundraising courses. I thought, some of those guys seem interested in that, and that's awesome. Like, that's great for them. That's just not where I see myself, nor have I ever really, not much considered myself stepping into that arena. And so that was kind of 8 months prior. Now Max is telling me to go out and visit Mike Story. And so I'm thinking, it's at a BCM, and I would be raising support. But I said, you know what, why not? Because at this point, nothing else is working out. So I drive out on the 4th of July. I called Mike, and he said, when are you coming out? And I said, well, I'm on my way right now. And he was like, oh, okay. So he calls and gets stuff set up. My dad wasn't really excited on the 3rd of July, the night before. But the next day, he gave me his blessing and told me that he loved me and for me to chase my dreams. So I got in the car and drove out, and it's like 13 and a half hours. Got there. The next day, me and Mike have breakfast. Mike says, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I didn't expect you to ask me that. What do you mean, what am I going to do? Like, you're kind of putting me on the spot here. And I really kept thinking the whole time I was there, I was going to go back to Lexington. Because I'd been reading a book that pretty much seemed to encourage whatever you think the hardest thing to do is, that's probably what God wants you to do, the scariest thing. And I thought the scariest thing would be going back to Lexington, not having a job, and just trying to move up there and make it work. So the whole time, in fact, that earlier that morning at Theta Pond at OSU, I'd thought, I'm just going to go back to Lexington. Just come out here, spend some time with Mike, it'll be great, maybe a week or two at the most, and I'll get in a car and drive back to Lexington. We'll be good to go. That's what I'll do, and I'll try to figure out when I get there. And then Mike looks at me and says, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm here, so I want to be here. And then the next day I looked up and realized, he looked at me and he said, I'll give you a place to work, I'll give you a place to sleep, and I'd love for you to be here. And I had worked at a church as an interim youth pastor while I was in Kentucky for a bit, and it was good for me to get that experience. When I went out there and Mike looked at me and told me those things, I thought, this is where I want to be. And the next day I realized this is the firmest conversation that you had. So Psalm 37, 23, and 24 came to pass at OSU. Because when God delights in, it says, if the Lord delights in a man's way, I'll make his steps firm. And he made my steps firm at OSU. So, I know sometimes it seems that people have a particular dream and they run with it. And obstacles get in the way and they barrel through them. That's because God specifically told them to go do something. For me, to not know where to go or exactly what to do, that dream had not been planted. All I knew was that if the Lord delighted in me doing something, He would make it clear to me because He would make the steps firm. So I think it's one thing... if God has told you to go do something, then you go do it. And if it seems as if the steps aren't firm, that's between you and God. It's something else when you're sitting and you don't know what to do because you've worked as an interim youth minister and you know your vision's not really clear because at this point you've kind of done a few different things and you're trying to figure out, God, where do you really want me here? In a church plant, do you really want me to work with college students on a campus? I never even considered working at a BCM. What do you want me to do? And it was at that point that's a different conversation, you know, than when God said to you, you plant a church in this city. Because then you go plant a church in that city. And if anything happens, you just plant a church in that city. Unless you, you know, severely hear God saying, don't do this. But for me, I didn't have that. So I was just like, okay, God, what do you want me to do? And then you just push, you know, and you try to find where God is, where God's leading you to be, where God wants you to be. I say all that because it's kind of, I don't know that we always think of, I think I can sit on this chair. I don't know that we always look at trials as this opportunity to advance, in the sense that there's a guy and he is cutting a horse out of a big piece of stone. And somebody comes along and they say, you know, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm making a horse. And they say, well, how are you going to get a horse out of that? And he says, I'm going to cut away everything that's not a horse. And so when we think about trials, in James 1, what's so beautiful about the trial is that God is the author of the trial. And if we can rest, again, you know, we come back to these convictions. If we can rest and be assured of Romans 8, 28 and 29, that says, for those he foreknew, he also predestined that they would be conformed to the image of his son, the firstborn among many brethren. If we can rest in that, that ultimately God wants us to look like Jesus. If we can rest in the fact that ultimately God wants us to look like Jesus, then no matter what circumstances come into our lives that are out of our control, and we know that God's sovereign over everything in the universe, so we can say, okay, God, there's something going on here. I don't understand exactly what it is, but ultimately I know that you want me to look like Jesus. And I know that you're in control of everything. So this trial, as long as I'll persevere in faith and hold on to you, this trial, I will come out of this looking more like Jesus. I want you just to take a minute. Let's see how we're doing. I want you to just take a minute and think about Genesis 1:1, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The scriptures tell us the story of what we know about God. We can learn a lot about God from creation, and we can learn about God from the scriptures. And in the story of God, we find our story, right? Because, I mean, I say this in the sense that, that God was before, and God creates the world, the universe. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And in the midst of this story of what God is doing in humanity, comes Psalm 139, that God reached into our mom's belly and started knitting us together. That some things happened and he worked, and none of us are an accident because he reached into our mother's belly and knit us together. So none of us are here by accident. And what happens is now that we are alive, our story happens in the context of the bigger story, right? Which is God's story, and what God, his story that he's writing with humanity. So by no means is God contained in all that we see about him. No, God is bigger. It's just what we know about him is what the scriptures tell us. And when he became active in creating humanity, that's what we know about. And so he knits us together, and forms us in our mom's belly. We pop out. Here we are. And it's now God's agenda, as it was when he started knitting us together, that we would look like Christ. Because Romans 8, 28 and 29 tell us that. And we take passages typically like Jeremiah 29, 11, and we rest on those passages. And we think, man, God has a blueprint for my life. Because it says, for I know the plans I have for you. And sometimes what happens is we do go into this treasure map mentality where we begin to try to hunt God down and find that place that I talked about earlier. And if we can just find that place, everything will come together. And what would twist us a little bit, what would shake that paradigm up is if we could really come to terms with the fact that Jeremiah 29:11 is not talking about blueprints, but that it's talking about thoughts. That God has thoughts for us, and that it's actually up to us as to whether we choose to step into those thoughts and those thoughts to become the story of our lives. Because what happens is, because we're born, we are responsible for our lives, and our story is being written. And sometimes we think that the daily decisions don't really make much of an impact. But in the larger scale of things, the daily decisions are so—they're everything. Because in the daily decisions, you've heard like we talk about clarifying wins. And what I've learned about us is that typically what we do is we clarify these huge things as a win. You win the Super Bowl—that's huge. What we don't celebrate is the daily activities that it takes to get there. We don't celebrate the two-a-days, because the two-a-days were part of being able to win the Super Bowl. And it's so funny because we think about, like, you know, Noah built the ark, but Noah was godly before he built the ark. And so many times I think we want God to give us this dream that's so much bigger than us, but we really don't want to follow God. We just want Him to drop this dream into our lap, and then we can pin it on God and say, well, you called me to do this, so I'm just going to go do it. When in reality, as we daily walk with Christ, as we daily follow God, as Luke 9:23 says, take up your cross daily and follow me, we begin to make decisions, and we step into this Jeremiah 29:11, these thoughts that God has for us, we begin to step into, because we begin to look more and more like Christ. And as we begin to look more and more like Christ, what happens is our hearts begin to be changed and morphed. And all of a sudden, we're able to look up and see things from a different set of eyes. For instance, we're able to look up and go, wow, I'd love to work at the BCM at Oklahoma State. I'll raise my own support. Even though 8 months prior, I was adamantly against it. But it's funny how through walking with Christ daily, these little trials and these things come along. And if we'll hold on, if we'll persevere, knowing that at the end of it, God wants us to look like Jesus, then what He's actually saying is, you will have more of my heart. And because we have more of His heart, we're willing to do the things that He calls us to do, where maybe previously we weren't willing to do those things, because they were kind of outside of our reason. What it really means is that we just weren't that interested in doing them. We haven't really caught that heart of God. And so in James 1, let me ask you, sometimes I jump around and just kind of go all over the place. Does that flow at all? Does that kind of flow? The great part is that we get to be conformed to the image of Christ. I think the harder part about it is that Rome was not built in a day. And so it literally is, and the very thing that I stunk at in college, it is the trip along the way. Like, that is life. And I heard Andy Stanley say something that I really like, and it's really true. He said, I know this about you because I know this about me. We want to be able to tell our whole story. So we are writing the story of our lives, and at the end of the day, we want to be able to look back and tell the whole story. So as we're making these decisions every day, one of the important questions for us to ask is, when I look up in the future, am I going to be glad that I made this decision? Am I going to be glad? Am I going to be able to tell this, or am I going to have to leave this out? You know what I mean? And when I sit down with my kids, am I going to be able to tell them that I went out on a date with this girl? Should I go out on a date with this guy? Is there something in me? Is there a tension in me that needs my attention that, you know, this probably isn't the wisest thing to do? Because as followers of Jesus, we're no longer looking at the good and bad necessarily. We've stepped in to looking at the good and the best. Like, we want the absolute best. Ephesians 5:15-17. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of the time, because the days are evil. So we've stepped into this best. It's no longer about what's necessarily just good and bad. It's what's the best thing that I can do in this moment. How can I seize this for all that it's worth? Okay, finally, we'll get to James, right? And in James chapter 1, it says, James, the servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. And perseverance must finish its work, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. So we see this picture that the trials are a blessing, because the trials are actually an opportunity for growth. Because in the midst of these trials, if we will hold on to the convictions and if we'll hold on to Christ, knowing who Christ is, trusting who He is, then we know that He'll see us through. And then when we get to the other side, if we have been obedient in this, that we will look at life differently. Now what's actually happening is He's chiseling away at the things that are not like His heart. Where we're not like-hearted with Him, He's chiseling away at those things. If you flip over to... Well, you don't have to flip there. I'll just read it. It's in Matthew chapter 6. I just thought about it yesterday. Well, He's telling us, do not worry. Don't worry about the things of this life.
That's 6.
Is it 6? That's what happens when you're not patient. Where's it at? There it is. Do not worry. Ha! Right in front of me. Sorry. Thought it was 6. He says, therefore I tell you, do not worry about what your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food, and the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Who of you by worrying can add a single hour to his life? He goes on to talk about clothes. So why do you worry saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. And He says, but seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Right before this, in verse 24, He said, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about what your life, about what you will eat or drink, or about your body, right? What you will wear. So, like, it's easy for us to say, I'm not going to worry about what I'll wear. But so many times, what happens is, it takes a trial for us to come through it, and for God to show us, it really does not stinking matter what you wear. Like, you can't worry about your clothes. And we say, well, you know, I'm not real worried about what I'm going to eat. Okay, so if you're going to be a missionary somewhere, your food may be determined, you know what I mean, by where you go. But you can say, I'm not really going to worry about what I eat. It's no big deal. But sometimes it takes a trial, I think, for God to bring us to the place where we really don't care what we eat. And it's there that we're okay with being a missionary. You know, you look at me and think, well, I don't want to go there. They eat all kinds of crazy food. Well, do you worry about you eat? No, I don't worry about it. I just don't want to go there. Because they eat all kinds of crazy food. And I'm just not interested in that. Okay, so now God may go into that person's life and give them a trial. And through that trial, what they learn is that they can eat anything. So now what are they? They're more equipped to go. And before, something that seemed like an obstacle has now no longer an obstacle. And what's beautiful is that that's the heart of Jesus, because that's what He's already said, is don't worry about what you eat. I'll give you what you need to eat. Those are essentials. You can trust me in those. I like to wear a certain kind of clothes. Okay, so if you go this place, you can't wear those kind of clothes. Well, you know, that's fine. I'm not going to go there, though, because I like to be able to express myself individually, you know. And then God may take me through a trial that shows me, just totally break me from anything that I don't even maybe even realize is there. You know what I mean? Sometimes we have these fogs and we think, hey, you know what, I'm really there. And God takes us through something and we look up and go, no, I really wasn't there. I thought I was there. I thought I was willing to do, God, whatever you wanted me to do. I just didn't want to work in a BCM or raise my own money because I wasn't passionate about that. And I'm not passionate about going overseas. I'm not passionate about going to that place because I can't express myself individually. I'm not passionate about going and living in a city because I'm used to being in the country. And so God may allow us to go through these trials to where what He's actually doing is He's cutting away the things that we've kind of adopted but aren't really His heart. And so it's beautiful because we look like Christ. It's tough because you really are removing the old stuff and the junk. And everybody knows that if you're going to paint a new car, you got to rough up the old paint. And so God, as we're willing, He will rough up the old paint in our lives. And as we hold on to His hand, He will put down new paint. We really will be conformed. We'll be broken to the conformity of the pattern of this world, and we will be transformed by the renewing of our minds, as Romans 12 says. And it's at those places that we look up and we're willing to do things. And it's so funny because I think sometimes people look and they think, wow, like, how'd you do that? When'd you get there? I talked to this guy and I'd never imagined that. He's over on the mission field and he seems excited about it. It's because Jesus has brought us to that, you know? And we've been willing to stay the course. And He's created in us a passion now to be over there because we've caught His heart on that. So that's why the trials are so beautiful. At the same time, they're so hard. But they're so beautiful because He is bringing us to a place of maturity. He's bringing us closer to completeness. And it's at that place where we'll lack nothing. And isn't that beautiful? Because it's the same nothing that He talks about, Jesus talks about in Matthew 6, where He says, don't worry about anything. These are the same nothings, that there's nothing for us to worry about. And when we're not worried about anything, and we're only focused on God, then we do lack nothing. Because we're only focused on God, and we've already trusted God to give us everything that we need. And it's funny, because then in verse 5, out of nowhere, He says, if you lack wisdom, he should ask God who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. It's almost to say, if you're in this trial, and you don't understand what's going on, but you notice that you're just kind of in a trial, ask God. Because He'll give you wisdom. And if you want to think about the trials and what do you ask in a trial, you ask just that. You ask God what? There's two different kinds of things to ask God. You can ask God what in two different ways. You can be the athlete that gets pulled off the field, and when he comes off, he looks at the coach and says, what? Like, why did you take me out of the game, coach? Or you can be the athlete that when the coach pulls him off the field, he looks up and says, what do I need to learn? Because obviously, you're the stinking coach. You know more about this than I do. What am I supposed to learn standing over here watching? Because there's something for me to learn here. And so in the midst of these trials, in the midst of circumstances that we can do nothing about, how beautiful it is when we come to Jesus and say, what? What do you want me to learn? There's things that are out of my control. You're sovereign God. You control everything. What do you want me to learn here? What am I supposed to be learning? And for me, it was learning to come to the BCM at Oklahoma State. It's a perfect picture. And my what was kind of like when I memorized that verse, I think. God, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it. I just need to know where it is. Let's see. And keep in mind, I had already had this, like I was already moving towards college ministry. So I wasn't on a treasure map mentality where everything was going to come together. I was just walking with God trying to figure out, okay, Lord, what do we do next? Like, where's the next step here? Because other doors have seemed to shut down, and where's the opportunities? And then it says, but when he asks, you must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That man should not think he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. So we're reminded of the goodness of God, that we can trust God. When we ask God for wisdom, we don't have to doubt, because God wants us to have wisdom. He wants us to know. That's the very reason of the trial, is the trial is an opportunity for us to be more conformed to the image of Christ. God is for us, not against us. And then down in verse 9, he says, the brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position, but the one who is rich should take pride in his low position, because he will pass away like a wildflower. For the sun rises with scorching heat and withers a plant. Its blossom falls and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he goes about his business. It says, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. And then after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, gives birth to death. Temptation. We talked about wisdom and how in the midst of this conversation about trials, because we know that's what James started with, was trials. So he's having a conversation with them about trials, and he talks about wisdom. Ask God for wisdom if you don't understand what's going on. And believe that he'll give it to you. Don't doubt, otherwise you won't get it. Then over in verse 13, temptation comes up. Why does temptation come up? I think temptation comes up because a trial is an opportunity to grow, and there's no growth that takes place without growing pains. And in the midst of growing pains, what do you want to do? You want to check out. The easiest thing to do is check out. The easiest thing to do is to run. So you think about, so it's true that in the midst of trials, temptations can arise. You think about Peter, who calls out to Jesus and says, if it's you, tell me to come to you. And Jesus says, well, come on. Come out to me on the water. Well, it was a trial, and now all of a sudden it's a temptation. Because what happens is when Peter walks out on the water, now he's faced with, I think, probably some sensuality in the sense that he feels the water rumble underneath him. He can feel the water splash on his face as the wind's blowing it, probably. He might be able to taste the salt a little bit in the air. He sees the waves with his eyes. And now he has an opportunity to take his eyes off Jesus. I shouldn't say opportunity, that's bad, because opportunity leads you to good things. Now temptation has arisen, and he finds himself in a place where he can either continue to focus on Christ or give in to temptation and take his eyes off Christ and become, I don't know, maybe fearful. And that's the reason that he started to sink. You know, Jesus says, oh, Peter, you have little faith. And so he doesn't exercise faith in the midst of his trial. And he starts to sink. Jesus grabs him, picks him up, takes him back to the boat. Jesus doesn't let him drown because he loves him. And aren't we glad that in the midst of some of our trials, when we flunk, or we only get so far, God doesn't just kick us out and say, well, sorry boys, you didn't pass the test. Not going to get to run the race with me. But instead, out of love, he picks him up and he takes him back to the boat. Because Peter calls out to him. And we're reminded that Peter walked on water, which hasn't typically happened. And Peter... John Randall's would say that Peter gets back in the boat, and probably there's people that are saying, the guys are probably saying, hey, we can walk on water. And Peter is probably saying, there's no we to it. I'm the only one that got out of the boat. You all stayed in the boat. So in theory, you can walk on water. But in reality, I'm the only one that actually got out and exercised faith and walked on water. So he says, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. Remember, these temptations will come up and they will present opportunities to run and to get out, because trials require faith. Faith, perseverance in faith brings us to completeness and maturity. I say completeness. None of us are going to be perfect this side of eternity. I don't think that. But it definitely does bring us more into the image of Christ. And so these temptations arise. And then he goes on to say, but each one is tempted. He says, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. So when tempted, no one should say, when you're in the middle of this trial and a temptation comes up, no one should say, God's tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone, but each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. Then after a desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin when it is full grown gives birth to death. Isn't it funny how in the midst of trials sometimes these emotions and thoughts come from within? And James is saying, even though this stuff comes up from within, don't think that it's God, because it's not. What it actually is it's your flesh, and it's craving to get out of the situation because your flesh wants to be comfortable. And trials, again, is like growth. And growth requires growing pains, and growing pains are not comfortable. And so naturally, our bodies crave sin. The flesh does. That's the reason the flesh enjoys it, is because it craves it. And in the midst of these trials, as we're trying to exercise faith, so many times our bodies will, from within, will have this this idea that, hey, I could just go do this and skip out on this. I don't have to hang in here. I don't have to do this. Is that what God really meant? You know, maybe you've asked God for wisdom and he's told you what he's teaching you. And in the midst of it, you know, maybe the trial is a little long. Maybe it's not. I don't know. But maybe in the midst of it, you look up and an opportunity comes along and you go, you know, you kind of catch this. Is it, you know, do you think, you really think God's still teaching you that? You know, you can quit. You don't have to do this. You could just go over here and do this. It would be more gratifying to the flesh. And so it comes with it from within, and James is telling us, don't look at God and say, God, why are you putting these temptations on me right now in the midst of this trial? You know, I'm sidetracked. I don't really know what to do, God. I've got these emotions coming up from within. And James is saying, if God's taking you through a trial and there's opportunities for us to learn and to be more conformed to the image of Christ, then when a temptation arises and it's to fulfill the flesh, don't look at God and say, hey, that's you, because God's not the author of that. And, of course, we know that God isn't going to call us to do anything that's contrary to the Scriptures, right? It's funny. If you think about it, God plants a dream in your life. When I say a dream, I mean that He gives you a passion. And you pursue it. And you know that it will take all of you to get there. And then maybe sometimes the temptation is just not to do it, but to do something else. Maybe God speaks into your life as a teacher or as a an accountant or as a doctor or as a BCM director or whatever it is, and He challenges you to do something. He puts it in you. This is the thoughts that He has for you. I'd love for you to step into this. And in the midst of you pursuing that, all of a sudden, you think, you know what, I really don't have to do this. I could just go back to, you know, I could just keep teaching and just do what I've been doing. I mean, isn't that, you know, was that displeasing to God? But God's actually trying to take you further. You know, the status quo has been left behind. Again, we're separating from what's kind of the, you know, what's just flat line, what it looks like to be a Christian, to actually what it looks like to follow Christ and to step into these things that God desires for you. Not to settle for a lesser, but to really pursue and say, God, here I am fully engaged. What would you have me do in this situation? So, I think, yep. What are thoughts, questions, or maybe wild remarks? Or any thoughts, questions, or wild remarks? Anything that needs clarity, or maybe I wasn't very clear? because I know I can hop at times. Or anything that you think has helped. I'm going to have to get a secretary to write all these questions down next time.
I think it helps to know that that in trials that, that there's a purpose to it. Mm-hmm. Not just like random or if you've done something wrong, but that God has a purpose for it and that you can grow more in maturity through that trial. I think that's really helpful to know that instead of just being like, I have all this pain and I don't know why. And it helps you kind of focus more, knowing there's purpose to it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely being able to, I think what I'm, because I hear you saying that there's a purpose in the trial, and so what that makes me think of is that God is sovereign, and He still is in control, and that He's allowed this, or purposed this to come into my life as an opportunity for growth, and being able to trust in His sovereignty, and not only His sovereignty, but His goodness. That at the end of the day, this is going to be for my likeness of Christ. Is there anybody that feels like they're in a trial right now? Yeah? What? Do you care to share it? You don't have to share it if you don't want to. Okay. That's fair. I should have asked you that. Since trials are personal, I have no business just pointing somebody out. I have no business pointing somebody out in a large room and saying, hey, you want to share what that one is? Sure, go ahead. Sorry. Yeah, that makes sense. I've had plenty of trials that I would share with the core, but not stand up in front of a room, so I'm a bozo. Sorry.
I found it helpful because I'm kind of where you were. It's just like, I'm doing dietetics, but that's like, I love health and nutrition, but I don't know exactly how that's going to all play out. So right now I'm like, okay, Lord, you have me in school still. So I'm going to finish that, and then it's just like, I don't know, so I don't have it all together, but that's okay. Like, mm-hmm. As long as, like, I am first of all seeking Him, and then things will.
And I think it's what's so beautiful is that God doesn't ask us to have it all together. He just tells us to follow Him, and He will develop our hearts and our character along the way. And so what's so stinking awesome is that you cannot begin to, we at times can't really begin to imagine the things that God desires to do through us. And we couldn't imagine ourselves being in places. So even if we could write the script for the future, we wouldn't pick it as close to Christ, I think, as God would have us be. You know what I mean? And it's through this walking with Him that He brings us to these places. And so what happens is because you haven't written out your future, you're only committing daily to follow Christ. As your character and everything begins to develop more and more and more, as I'm sure it has already a lot, then your heart begins to be more open to things that God has. And all of a sudden, it's possible that you look up somewhere in a place you would have never imagined yourself being. How did you get there? You didn't write your future. I mean, you wrote it because you daily walked with God. But you didn't set these boundaries up and said, at the end of the day, this is what I'm going to do, God, no matter what. So I'm going to take you with me. It was more like, I'm going to walk with you. And in the moment, I'll pray, and if I don't know what to do, and I don't sense you telling me no, I'm going to go. And I'll be obedient. And I trust you that when you don't want me to do something, that you'll tell me. I think so many times we get gridlocked because we think, and sometimes our doctrine, I think, kind of can murky up our water for us. Sometimes we get gridlocked because we don't really know what to do, so we just don't do anything until we feel like God really does drop just something straight in our lap and tell us what to do next. And we have to continue to pursue Christ. I mean, you gotta work to pay bills. So maybe when things aren't opening or opportunities aren't coming, you just be faithful where you are and you keep pursuing Jesus and saying, hey, this is what I'm interested in doing, and you keep knocking on doors trying to find a way in. Instead of just setting and saying, well, when the right opportunity comes along, because our generation takes the word opportunity and turns it into this this moment where God's done everything and all we have to do is live in it. But opportunity, if you look up the King Jimmy, the old King, the New King Jimmy, New King James Version, says redeem the time. When he talks about Colossians 4, 5, and 6, make the most of every opportunity, the New King James says redeem the time. And I think, how much more aggressive does that sound in 2012 than make the most of every opportunity? Because we typically think as opportunity is something that God's going to create for us. And we don't think, in the context of that verse, he's talking about make the most of every opportunity, let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so you know how to answer everyone. He's talking about conversations with the outsiders. Well, redeem the time, you grab an outsider, and you start having a conversation with them. You know, you don't wait on God to drop somebody in your lap. Now all of a sudden, hey, the setting's just right, I'll talk to this person about Jesus. So anyway, side note, sorry. I will say this. This is kind of a newer conversation that I think I've stepped into a little bit. Our generation, me too, struggles with commitment. We struggle with committing to things. Because we're always afraid, I think, of the future, that we're not really sure what the future is going to be like. And so we're afraid to commit. And I just want you to toss this around some, because I'm tossing it around some, is if commitment is actually an opportunity to step into the future and create the future for us, in the sense that, this is the last thing I'll say, in the sense that in James, he's talking about them, they made their plans, and he's talking about them going, and saying that they're boasting about tomorrow. He says, now listen, you say, today or tomorrow we will go into this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why do you not even know what will happen tomorrow? What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast and brag, and all such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins. So it's not boasting. It's just saying that when people call us to make a commitment, if we can look up and see that those things are biblical and those things are things that honor God, and at the same time, if we can look up and say, that's something that I need to be, and we know that most likely we'll be in that place, then why not commit? Because what we're actually doing is saying, if the Lord wills it, and I'm here, and I'm in this place, and I'm alive, I have created the future for myself. For those of you who signed up last year, you left the Glen knowing that you were going to go to the Glen this year. What you did was create your future. Because you said, I'm going to the Glen. My spring break has been created. You know what I mean? So you've actually stepped into the future by making a commitment and saying, I know what this week is going to look like to some degree. And you don't boast about it. You just say, God, I'm planning on doing this. I'm praying about it. Lord, if you don't want me to do it, you tell me and I won't do it. Otherwise, I'm going to make this commitment. I'm going to make this decision. And if everything works out and you allow it, then this is where I'll be and this is what I'll be doing. I'm just tossing some of this stuff around because we struggle so bad with commitments because we always think about leaving one thing to do something else. And we're so much about just kind of like, I don't know, we don't think very much about being able to actually make decisions that impact the future. And yet, as we know, all these little decisions about following Jesus every day actually creates the person that will be tomorrow. So in a sense, we're kind of creating the future anyway, as long as God allows us to be here and allows it. So anyway, you can just toss that around. And by no means do I mean to put that in the black and white thing and say that that's exactly the way it is. But it's been something I've been thinking about. So, anyway, cool.